Madam Chairman, distinguished guests and friends of the Farm and Home Week, I am very happy to be here with you today. And I especially appreciate the privilege of visiting with you yesterday and getting to know some of you better personally, to meet you and to find out some of the things that you are doing here in Illinois. As you know, every state has a different way of reaching the same objectives. And it's been very inspirational for me to be here and see how your Home Bureau carries on an excellent program here in this state. When we think of the American family in today's world, we first think of our own family. That is inevitable. The picture that forms in our mind is that of the ones and the places closest to our hearts. To me, it means a white frame Dutch colonial house nestled beneath hackberry trees, bordered with shrubs and flower beds. Within the house, I see an elderly man of 87 with blue eyes and a mind filled with stories of yesterday, but yet concerned with all of the topics of today. Sitting near him, I see a very large, dark-haired older woman with an exceedingly high brow and that slightly strained expression seen frequently on the faces of the blind. I know that in her dear head there is an inestimable knowledge and wisdom gathered over 83 years of continuous education. Coming in the house or going out of it, always in a rush, I see a man of 42 with a kind but teasing expression, a clear, keen face, and a waistline just beginning to expand. He is apt to be calling out some such question as this: Katie, have you seen my wrenches? I used them day before yesterday, and I think I left them on the back porch. Then I see two youngsters rushing in the house to brag about the fact that they've gotten out the tractor and the plow and plowed for an hour between school and time to do the chores. And we got a lot plowed after school today, Aunt Kitty, they brag. To complete the picture, I see a buff-colored collie dog bouncing around in high glee because all members of the family are actually at home at one time. She's a rather large dog, and she sheds light-colored hair on the furniture, and her master thinks that she has no place in the house. But when no one is looking, her master lets the door open just wide enough for her to slip in. That is the first picture I see when I say American home. Now you stop a moment. Close your eyes. What do you see? Yes, it's your own family, isn't it? You see your house, your husband, your wife, children, relatives, and pets. Some of you see someone who used to be there, but is not there now. A little lump may form in your throat when you remind yourself that he is away. But so long as he lives, he carries with him that picture of your family indelibly engraved on his heart. As you make that picture day by day, you paint the masterpiece of your life. Instead of canvas, you work on living members of your family. Instead of brushes, you make your strokes with love, understanding, counsel, and discipline. Yes, that discipline is an important part, too. Instead of silent, changeless pictures, your masterpiece is your own American family. N.P. Willis once said, "The highest triumph of art is the truest presentation of human nature." How much higher is the art of creating that human nature in your own family? In the beginning, God created Adam and Eve and gave them a garden. From them came the world's first family. That family had in it the good and the bad. Over the thousands of years from the beginning, families have developed changing patterns of life. Some have been good and some have been bad. Some patterns have varied. They have all varied, in fact, in different countries, in their ages, and in their standards. In our own America, The pattern has been and still is constantly changing. It has evolved from the colonial survival of the fittest to the super scientific laboratory tested formulae used by some homemakers today. It has changed from the gun-toting homesteader to the mortgage-carrying installment buyer of today. Yes, the pattern changes constantly, and in change we must build stability. What then is the American family pattern today? What is the place of the family? It is the bulwark of the nation, and today it is the hope of the world. The strength of any civilization lies in the home, because the home establishes the thinking, the standards, and the ideologies of the men and women of tomorrow. Today, peace and freedom can be won only in men's minds. Guns, armies, atomic bombs all play a part, but the final victory will be one of ideology, not of material gains. Today we are faced with the greatest and at the same time the most insidious enemy that has faced man since the Garden of Eden. This time the serpent offers golden apples of security. Security through socialism. Security through communism. The job of the family is to grade these apples, to separate the hand-picked from the windfalls, to detect the specks and the rotten cores. And just as the inspector trains for his job, so must the American citizen train for his. Likewise, just as the agency that sends forth the inspector is responsible for his ability to judge, so the family is responsible for the judgment of the citizens it sends forth. We shall assume that we are all agreed upon the responsibility of the family. The important question is how to achieve it. Experts on family relations have written volumes on this subject. I could commend to you a number of books if you but had the time and the inclination to study further. You would gain much, I promise you, from reading these. On the other hand, if we had several semesters in which to study together these findings, we really might delve into the field somewhat. Unfortunately, in the limited time we have here this afternoon, we cannot approach it from the angle of an expert. Maybe that isn't unfortunate, for I am not an expert. I am just a fellow lay home worker. So I shall attempt to think with you along only a few of the lines that seem most important to me. From these, perhaps we may select a criteria for family action. First, the entire family must learn to think. That is hard. Sometimes it hurts. Always it takes practice. You do not expect a pupil to play a musical instrument without endless hours of practice. You do not expect a veterinarian to treat your sick animals without years of study and practice. Yet some people expect children to think clearly as naturally as they eat. Some adults purport to be able to think the world out of any dilemma without study and without ability to judge. Usually such people stubbornly argue by repeating what they have heard or read or criticizing anyone who does anything. Haven't you met those people? They have no constructive suggestions. They are what I call blank-minded negativists. Yet these very people are usually loud and long in their protestations. Joseph Pulitzer said, "The only position a man can successfully fill by the simple fact of birth is that of an idiot." In order to think, you have to study, concentrate, and select. You can read or listen and absorb until, like a sponge, you drip. And that's all you will be, a drip. But in order to have a background for thinking, you do have to keep yourself informed. Maybe some of you heard the rumor about the lady not too far from here who was caught sitting in her living room with a paper in her hand, the radio turned on, and the receiver of the party line telephone to her ear. When chided, she explained, "Well, I have to be informed." Seriously, we do have to be informed. whatever the source. The opinions of men are based upon information that reaches them. Opinion can be sound only when that information is adequate in quality and in quality. Opinion governs action, and individual opinions taken collectively form public opinion and shape all public action. In practice, most information reaching the adult members of the family is disseminated through press, radio, television, or films. The newspapers and the news agencies that serve them exert an especially powerful continuous influence because they reach a large number of people each day. As the world has grown in complexity, it has become increasingly apparent that the events in almost any segment of the globe affect the lives of millions. So also, economic conditions in one group affect those of other groups, as for example, the prices to the farmer greatly affect labor and industry, and vice versa. Perhaps we have here one of the weakest links in farm efforts. For years, and even today in some cases, farmers have been prone to say that they could paddle their own canoe and did not want assistance from others. Farmers are by nature the most independent people in America. Thank heaven they still exist. They were at one time the most influential by virtue of their numbers. They controlled Congress and state legislatures because they had more voters than any other sector of our economy. That no longer is true. Today, farm people have less than one-fifth of the population and voting strength of the nation. So if farmers do not explain their policies and convert other segments of the country to their way of thinking, farm programs and farm policies cannot be guaranteed. Of course, at this point, I must say that this conversion can be obtained only through a united effort on the part of leading farm people and may be expressed through a large and effective organization. But through these organizations, as well as through local contacts, the farmer needs and must have good public relations with all other groups. You know, as we have said before, we are dependent upon the standard of living that wage earners procure from our standards. Why? Because if labor cannot afford to buy milk, butter, eggs, beef, and other farm products, the farmer cannot have necessary money for maintenance of a decent living standard for his family. And so it is with business. In order to keep industry at full production, both the farmer and the laborer must have decent income. We are bound by the closest economic ties one to the other. We must not fight each other, but all must work together for a better economic condition for all. Now, when we work for our own advancement, if other persons do not see the relationship of our progress to theirs, they are very apt to fight our progress. They are very apt to say that we are a self-centered group. Today, they are saying the farm family is getting rich while the city child is suffering for lack of milk and beefsteak. What is our way of explaining this? Well, we might take either of two roads. One would be to say to them, we must make a decent living for our families. That we shall do, and what becomes of you, we do not care. We shall bind together and force legislation that will suit us. You do what you can. Or we might take the other road and say, friends, we are one nation. We want one standard of living. We want every American to have a chance to make for himself all that he can. Let us sit down together and see how these problems of common interest can be solved to the advantage of your group and ours. Last week, the American Farm Bureau Federation Board, while it was in session in Washington, called just such a conference of press representatives. At the beginning, the presidents of the Associated Women and the American Farm Bureau Federation made statements about price control. Then the press asked questions. Some of the questions turned out to be debates. One example of the lack of the meeting of minds came from a city woman editor. Mr. Klein had made his famous explanation of hog production in relation to costs and prices. Those of you who are Farm Bureau members know what I'm talking about. This lady editor made this observation. Mr. Klein, I do not see why farmers have to make so much profit per animal. Let's take beef. I'm more interested in that than I am in pork. Now, I have a friend who operates a dress business. He does not attempt to put but 25 cents profit on each dress. In order to make a larger profit, he just makes more dresses, and that's all there is to it. Now, if the farmer is as patriotic as you say, why does not he just raise more beef and sell each one for a smaller amount of profit? As I see it, he would make 10 times as much if he sold 10 times as many cows. Then we, the consumer, could afford to buy the beef, and you, the producer, would be rich, and we'd have a happy solution. That lady was really sincere, friends. She was serious. She did not know one thing about the facts of life involved in animal breeding. Time, labor, breeding, capital outlay meant nothing at all to her. She could see layers of material cut out in a given size, stitched and put on the market. What she had never seen was the development of a fine young heifer, the expense of a good sire, the length of time required for inception and the year needed for the marketing of the yearling. One of the good presidents arose to the occasion and explained these factors to her in very simple and very understandable language. She saw the light. She said no one had ever brought out that explanation in her presence before, and she had never thought it through for herself. How many other persons present had failed to understand the fundamental law of farm production, we do not know. But we do know that all of them were gently reminded or taught this lesson. This is but one sample of the immense job of consumer-producer problems that must be understood if the farm family is to have the sympathetic support of the public which it so badly needs.